The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
Live from the Space Talk Radio Studios, it's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting live to four continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy, here's the founder and host of The Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Sunday Space Show. For those of you in the United States or elsewhere and that happen to be fathers, a great happy Father's Day to you. And thank you for joining the Space Show. On this day, we get to recognize and appreciate all our dads. So again, happy Father's Day to everyone out there in Space Show world. We have a great program today. It's going to be a real treat. Let me get through the announcements quickly so we can start with our guest as quickly as possible. For those of you that would like to call our show today and talk to our guest, Chuck Walker, who I will introduce in just a minute, that MCI toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Let the phone ring until it is answered, and then be patient until we can bring you up on the show. But as soon as it's answered, you are on the air. Do not listen to a stream of the show at the same time. It will feed back, and it won't be a successful phone call. If you want to communicate with email, use either of the following three accounts: dmlivings@yahoo.com, drspace@thespaceshow.com, or thespaceshow@gmail.com. For those of you that prefer chat using AOL's Instant Messenger, ICQ, or CompuServe, it's all the same screen name, Space Show Chat, one word. Also, again, visit the www.spaceinvestor.com site. Thanks to Ken for putting up the Space Show message board. You'll see community on the lower left. Click on that, then media, then the Space Show. And we appreciate your using that. And then visit our website, thespaceshow.com. This program will be archived later today as an MP3. It will also be available at the same time for podcasting. And check out the comprehensive newsletter. It is uploaded every Monday morning, and whenever new news or developments or changes in the schedules come about. If you want to receive the shortened email version of the newsletter, send an email to drspace@thespaceshow.com or use the pop-up window on the website, and we'll be happy to enter your name in that subscription. While you're at the website, please visit the Space Show store and also the Support the Space Show button. It's a big undertaking to do anything in space. Believe me, anything. And that includes the Space Show. So we appreciate those of you that contribute to the show, and we thank you. Everything helps. I promise you that. And if you can, keep on doing it. It's, as I said, a big effort to keep the Space Show going and to strive toward becoming spacefaring. So we appreciate and thank all of those who do support and will be supporting the Space Show. As I said a few minutes ago, we are in for a treat today. Our guest is Chuck Walker. He is author of the new book published by Apogee, Atlas, The Ultimate Weapon. This is one cool missile used for our defense and military purpose, and also used for our space program. And Mr. Walker is, along with his co-author, Joel Powell, wrote this incredible book with phenomenal color pictures in it. I am not kidding you, of various atlases in various stages of launch and development. You will not want to miss getting a copy of this book. Also, before I finish introducing our guest, I'm going to do a trivia question. Stay tuned, probably after the first break. And whoever calls the show on the toll-free line and successfully answers the trivia question gets a copy of this book sent to them in the mail. Mr. Walker was a key participant in the Atlas program from 1953 to 63 with the prime contractor Convair Astronautics, which later became General Dynamics. He began his career with Convair in 1945 as an aircraft test engineer, later moving to the test planning group of Atlas in 1953. He then served as manager of program planning control for Atlas from August of 58 to June of 63. In his role of establishing the schedules of all work done at Convair Astronautics, Chuck Walker came to know personally many of the people who were responsible for running the Atlas program, and it is those people that Walker approached to tell the amazing story of the Atlas program in their own words. It's a story that we're going to talk about today, and it's a story you absolutely must read about if you care anything about our country's military programs and our civilian and commercial space programs. Welcome to the program, Mr. Walker. How are you today?
Thank you. I'm doing fine. I didn't know if you want me to address you as Dr. Space or Dr. David or David?
David is fine, and you know, thank you for asking. I've been reading this book, and it's an amazing book, and I think we all know that the Atlas exists, but I had no clue about its history, its significance, when it was actually conceived and started. Why don't you just sort of start us at the beginning and tell us why Atlas is important?
Well, it was the first line of defense against the Russians, who were developing large rockets and nuclear bombs also. And so it was kicked off with a bunch of committees that had to agree with each other in the government, which is coming to rare, as a means of defense and retaliation just in case. And the first part of it was started by several proposals which the Air Force asked for, and different kinds of missiles, all 5,500 nautical miles carrying a bomb. And these missiles were cruise missiles and ballistic missiles, and they decided that ballistic missiles were probably the best bet, and Convair was first in that contracting. That happened back in the early 50s. There was a MX-1593 contract that Convair worked on. They also had had a contract to develop a Micron American V-2, and a fellow named Bossert, Carl Bossert, was the head project manager, and they came up with what Convair called the HIROC, H-I-R-O-C, which was basically a German V-2, and they built two of them. They had money for, or three of them, they had money for more to begin with, but like all things in the government, they got cut back. They built three of these that flew, and they never did get a flight full duration, but they got increasing altitudes with each shot, and it was a forerunner of some of the Atlas features. The German V-2 used carbon blocks behind the exhaust to steer the thing, and the blocks that he rode and the effect of moving the blocks was thereby changed, and they couldn't steer them very accurately. It had a very poor guidance system that wouldn't get you very precisely anywhere in the vicinity of a big city like London, of course. And Charlie Bossert decided to swivel the engines, and he developed some ideas about a nose cone that he said, why build a missile to re-enter the whole thing? It'd have to be very heavy that way if the whole missile came in again and survived. Why don't we just release the nose cone in the opening trajectory and let it lob into the target area? That was a new thing. And then the last one that he thought up was not included in the HIROC, but it was conceived and they thought about it, didn't have time to develop it. That was to make the fuel tanks and the structure integral. So Charlie Bossert came up with this idea of basically making a steel balloon that had to be pressurized to be structural. Like if you have a long, skinny balloon and it isn't pressurized, it just whips all over. But you pressurize it and it'll sustain some lateral loads. Well, that was the idea with this steel balloon. They made the tanks out of stainless steel. It was about the thickness of a dime. It had a concave bulkhead, a concave up, or concave down, I guess. It was the dome was up, and they put the locks up above, the fuel down below, and so unless you add pressure in there all the time, the tank would collapse, and of course that led to some major problems that as long as they were careful, it would work out all right. Well, they had a very highly efficient structure, high fuel load per pound of weight, and you'll read all about that in the book. But anyway, it was quite an undertaking, and the size decreased. They originally had seven booster engines and a 12-foot tank, and they, as the bomb developed and got lighter and lighter, well, it finally ended up as a 10-foot diameter, about 85 feet long tank or missile, and the accuracy retained. So it was quite a tremendous undertaking. I got to thinking about this and trying to put it into common terms, but the missile warhead had to come down within 1 nautical mile, at least half of the shots within 1 nautical mile of the target, and that's from shooting from 5,500 nautical miles away, which would be a little over 6,000 statute miles. And that's the equivalent of, if you're shooting a basketball, which has a 1 foot diameter, roughly, hoop, going a mile away and shooting a hoop and either hitting the hoop or going in, that's about the equivalent in terms of the sporting activity. And that's pretty darn good. And it got so it could do this almost every time. We shot some Atlases, 9,000 nautical miles, or statute miles, I guess it was, which went over Africa. And the tanks burned up and went into the jungle, and some natives recovered a piece of it and brought it out. It had some writing on it. So it was kind of easy to determine where the tanks ended up. And, of course, they tracked these all the time, so they could calculate where it went down. It was quite an amazing vehicle. But, of course, it was also dangerous. The 120,000 pounds of fuel and locks takeoff was equivalent to 120,000 pounds of TNT, and we had some really amazing blow-ups with the thing. If the pressure system failed and let the bulkhead reverse, visualize the lower tank was pressurized to hold the upper tank as well, and if it collapsed, the fuel came down through the tank and mixed with the oxygen, or the other way around, and made a giant bomb, and we blew up some test stands, total smithereens, you might say, by that. And so it was quite a striking progression of actions that worked.
This was being engineered and built in, you know, the mid-50s to the 60s. How state-of-the-art did the engineering and the manufacturing processes have to be in order to create an accurate and reliable Atlas missile?
Well, the big thing was the guidance system. That had to be very precise, and in those days it was difficult to miniaturize anything, and they had the Burroughs Company working with General Electric guidance with the data from the missile going up, tracked by radar and signals going back and forth to steer the engines, were processed by a great bank of building full of computers, and that was the biggest state-of-the-art thing, but there were very few others, even though it was an unusual design. The welding techniques that were used were apparently non-stretching the state-of-the-art, but it was took pretty precise tooling to hold the structure concentric and all that. And there were some elements of the Atlas. They had tanks made out of titanium to carry pressurized helium to provide, or nitrogen, I guess, to pressurize the tanks within flight. And those helium tanks are, what do I say, titanium type.
Right.
Tanks are about a half inch or 3/4 inch thick. And welding all those from one side was quite a learning process. They finally developed things so they could handle those that way. But there weren't a lot of state-of-the-art developments. The engines, of course, were developed by Rocketdyne, and they were fairly well along when the Atlas program kicked off, and it wasn't an amazing thing technically, except for the guidance and the concepts, and we were remarkably successful, although we had a ratio of maybe 50% successes in the early days. It gradually got better and better, and it's up in the 95% or so now.
There were many Atlas with alphabetical letters going up through G or maybe past G, and then there were also Atlas missiles with names like the Centaur and the Agena. What's the difference between the different Atlas missiles with their different designations?
Well, the Atlas missiles changed in configuration. They started out with a forward tapered tank, and it became evident that we're going to get into space distance business or satellite pushing, we had to get a second stage. Well, the Agena was a second stage developed by Lockheed, and it pretty well fit the Atlas missile as far as structural size and shape and load that could be carried. It could put a few thousand pounds into a geosynchronous orbit. And the Centaur was a bigger second stage built up to the same diameter as the Atlas. Used tooling from Atlas to make the tanks in 10-foot diameter. Same concept of bulkheads and all. Now, that was a real state-of-the-art process at Centaur. They used a liquid hydrogen engine and oxygen, and that liquid hydrogen is very, very difficult stuff to handle. It came along after the hydrogen bomb was in work, and the government had developed processes for making hydrogen and for handling it. But it would escape through the tiniest crack. It was it oozed through a crack a thousandth of an inch wide, and it could catch fire very easily. In fact, the Pratt & Whitney engineers reported that the flames from hydrogen weren't really visible when it was burning. So they'd wrap Kleenexes around some of the joints that were considered to be leakers, and when that catch fire, they could see that burning. And that's a funny technique, but it worked for them. But that took an awful lot of manufacturing and inspection from to see about leaks and whatnot, and it's just really very state of the art. Had a lot of problems with the early Centaurs, but when they finally got them locked down completely as far as production techniques and how to find problems there, they had very remarkable successes.
And I know I'm jumping ahead in the story, but the one picture in your book, it's a color picture on page 216, always, floored me in a way because it shows an Atlas with Russian engines on it. It's an Atlas III at a Lockmart test in 1999. How did it come about having a Russian engine on it?
Well, 9 years ago when I started this thing, I talked to the people that are still alive who were involved deeply in Atlas, and one of the engineers that was still consulting told me he was looking into a use of a Russian engine for Atlas. And the way that Atlas flew, I hope most of your customers know this, but they had two booster engines that were diametrically opposed and a sustainer engine in between them. And all three engines were lit off at launch because at that time it was difficult to get reliable starts in flight, and so it was decided to light them all at launch. And as it went off and burned down, the outer engines were dropped off with a bunch of other things that they didn't need anymore, like a pressurization bottle that was used up. And then the second part of the Atlas with the sustainer only kept going. Well, that wasn't efficient as a multi-stage rocket, but the Russians developed a big engine that called the RD-10, I think, but it could be throttled, and it could throttle back from its maximum thrust down to about 15-20% of it. So what they did this was going to replace the propulsion system because it would boost as much as the other engines, and then would be throttled back to keep the axial acceleration down to no more than the other engines had caused, so they wouldn't have to go back and develop a whole new line of components. And that was called the Ergomesh engine, And to me, it was quite a contrast that here to help boost a missile that had been developed to be aimed at Russia just in case, to start using a Russian engine was remarkable. And that goes aboard the Atlas III and V, which are the latest versions of Atlas made by Lockheed Martin. And not too long ago, the last steel balloon Atlas, which was part of the Atlas III, was flown. And they're gone to a structure now that is self-supporting and, of course, a little easier to handle, but it's not near as efficient weight-wise. And but they've had remarkable, reliable flights with those.
What was involved in putting a man on an Atlas? Did they have to make major changes in the safety of the rocket, or was it just converting it to take the hardware to support the guy?
Well, it wasn't. They didn't have to make many changes. The Atlas has boosted the Mercury capsule up, and I think they might have increased some of the gauges on the front end for bending, you know, without a heavier weight up there where they didn't usually. But it was very versatile, and the big thing there was the Atlas missile at that time was, as far as the weaponry, it was only maybe 50-60% reliable. So the risk there was, if any, was in how well we could, and careful we could engineer the and test and prove out the missiles that would be flying men up and keep them highly reliable. Well, it worked out. We shot four of them into space with no problems at all, and worked out very well. They did develop a very fancy abort sensing and instrumentation system that would have working from transducers all over the missile, measure characteristics and compare them, and if it looked like the missile might stand a chance to fail, well, it'd shoot off the nose capsule, and it could come down with parachute recovery. But it took an awful lot of deep thinking to evaluate all the parameters that should be contributing to this system, and then to make sure that everything was reliable, because if that system should fail, well, it would be just boarding any kind of a safety system. And the project manager that told me that he felt they'd spent more developing that system, which they called ASIS, than they'd spent on the program for the missile itself. And we were fortunate, and we got all these off. And one of the interesting things that when John Glenn went up, I think he had three orbits, but the missile body itself went around for five or six orbits. It stayed up longer than he did, but the last launch was the Shirah, and he, or Gordy Cooper, I guess, and he went around 32 orbits, so it worked out very well.
What was the failure rate of launching an Atlas?
Well, depending on when you did it. Early in the days, it was pretty low, but as time went by, it got quite high. Yeah, the latest thing is they had a string of around 75 launches with no failures of the different, more recent versions.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was.
So that probably holds the record, I would imagine, right?
Well, as far as I know, it does. We don't know what Russia's up to or what they have done, but they've had a lot of problems. They developed big engines much quicker than we did, but they've had more problems with them, and I don't think there's anyone to touch it now. The French have developed the Ariane, which is a big missile, and I don't even know where they shoot it from, but it's been pretty reliable.
It doesn't have a track record of 75 successes.
Well, I don't know. It might have. I just don't know anything about that missile.
Let me pause for just a second. This is a good point to put out our trivia question to see if someone can answer it and then win a copy of this great book, Atlas, the Ultimate Weapon. And you need to call the show on the 800 number with a question or comment for our guest today and, of course, the correct answer. That always helps. That toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. And our question today, all of you should be able to answer this, is what is the date and the year that Captain Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier? again, the date and the year that Captain Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier. If you're the first one to call with a comment, question, and the correct answer, you win a copy of this book. And again, that toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. Why did they ultimately retire the Atlas? Was it just outdated, or there's better products?
As far as a military weapon goes, it was fuel. It had to be fuel, liquid fueled, and they couldn't leave the thing stored with the liquid fuel in it. They might have, but it was quite risky. And,
right.
And it took about, 15 minutes initially to tank the fuel, and later on they got it down to 8 minutes, but that's still pretty long if your incoming ICBM is on its way. So the Minuteman with the solid propellant base could be shot almost immediately, and they retired Atlas and Titan IIs and put them both in mothballs or space use in and replaced them with the Minuteman.
We do have a caller on the line. Let's bring him or her on. Hello, are you there?
I am.
And do you know the correct answer? Do you have a question or comment for our guest today, Mr. Walker?
Both. I believe the answer is October 14th, 1947.
You win his great book.
And the question I have relates to the construction of the original atlases, which were essentially metal balloons, as he's mentioned. And how did that change the difficulties of ground handling compared to the more rigid structured missiles that were under development at that same time?
Well, they were much trickier. You had to be careful. They had two ways of transporting. One was by maintaining small pressures. It didn't take much, which held the Atlas in shape. But the other was you could stretch them. They had attachments to the front and rear that you could tie into and keep the tank stretched, and that would hold its shape. So either one had to be done very carefully. And in the tower, of course, it's vital. They had to keep pressures up, and it was for wind loads and for general safety. And they had differential pressure measuring that would keep blow horns when the pressure across the intermediate bulkhead got too close to zero, you know. And it was tricky. And Martin, that's one of the things they've done. They developed the improved ground handling systems for the Atlas when the steel balloon is still being used. But now the Atlas is a honeycomb ground milled out panels, you know, and self-supporting. They got rid of the problem that way.
Yeah, wouldn't that be at the expense of more dead weight on the rocket?
Yeah, it's not near as efficient as far as the weight of a propellant to structure ratio.
Okay.
All right. And this is John, so make sure I have your current address to send you his book.
Okay, I think you do.
Okay. Any other comments for Mr. Walker?
No, I think it's an interesting show, and I look forward to listening to the rest of it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chuck, how was the threat of an Atlas missile perceived by the Soviet Union?
Well, we don't know how they thought about it all. I've never talked to anybody that could answer that question. But we were very concerned about their work. You know, they took a bunch of the German scientists after the war and put them to work. And they did some great developments for big engines, but I don't know how. Their bombs were behind us by several months, or maybe a year, and so we were ahead, but we had to keep ahead. There was a guy named Trevor